You know, the prisons, the religions. Don and I got a friend named Jim, he got saved 43 times, never got sober. It's not the Lord's fault at all. It just didn't work. We got another friend named Tom, who at 19 years old ended up in a very expensive psychiatric center in Denver called Mount Airy. Great name for a nut house, isn't it? Mount Airy for the airheads. And they put him through the old aversion treatment. And some of you know what that is. Some of you heard me talk about it. But what that was, and it was in a hospital setting, and it still goes on some places today. It's medieval, but it still goes on. And they put him in a room that was roughly 12 foot square, I guess. And I saw the room in one of these places once. And the walls are all mirrored, and there's shelves on the walls with all different kinds of liquor. In the middle of the room is a barber chair. And on one armrest of the barber chair is a stainless steel pot that swivels in front of whoever's in the chair, away from him. And they gave Tom some antabuse, and they sent him into that room and told him he could have anything he wanted to drink on all those bottles of liquor. And the idea of this, of course, is he's going to drink on top of the antabuse, he's going to get violently ill, and he's going to watch himself in those mirrors while his hair falls out and his eyes cross and his toenails curl. He's just going to be so adverse to it, he'll never take another drink. And a few years later, when Tom came to us, he explained to us that it worked. He said it really did. He'd not had reason or excuse to take antabuse since. And I share that story because Tom was one of those people I watched. Tom's stone crazy. Craziest son of a bitch ever knew. So, maybe still is. But he was one of them that I watched, and he came in. There must be a God. It must be working. I read all this, and it didn't make much sense other than one line, and I'll share that with you in a minute. But I sat in that meeting, and we read this chapter to me, and all I know is God was getting drunk sober because I watched it happen in Amy. And somehow or another, I guess that was going to work for me. It had to. There must be a God. There better be a God. And the second step happened to me. But what happened to me is, on page 46 down there, it says that we found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, is never exclusive or forbidding. To those who earnestly seek, it is open, we believe, to all men. And I guess that's the first time I ever felt welcome with him. And that's the best way I can share the second step, is it happened to me. Can't say that I set out to take it. It was a natural thing that happened by what we were doing in our work with the book and with each other. Done.
We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results on page 46. Then I'm challenged on page 47. When therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourselves what they mean to you. And I began to realize one of my problems. I had never thought. I never had an original thought in my life. I'd been stealing your thoughts and trying to live by what they meant to you. So the awakening was, all I have ever heard in my life were lies. I didn't mean you lied to me. All I ever heard were lies, because I heard your truth, not mine. And once again, what they had told me early on, they said, Don, we suggest you forget everything you think you know about anything, particularly spiritual matters, because none of it has worked. I've got to have my own experience of the thing so it can become my truth. And I screamed at him. I said, surely I've learned something. And he says, it's doubtful, but it's possible. But if you have, it'll still be the truth when we're all through. And the rest of it's all lies. Just let it go. Forget it. What do these terms mean to you? Well, when we finished going through it, the word God didn't mean anything to me. When the truth came out, I didn't have a concept of God that was my own. And to this day, I'd be hard-pressed to give you a concept. I can describe a lot of things that I think are experiences. I don't have much of a concept. But then I'm really challenged. I hear around the A that there's no must. Well, there's no must for hanging around. But the book is filled with them. And here's one of them, if I want to pursue this path. It says we need it. That's another way of saying must, I think. On page 47, it says, we need it to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? What a trick. I don't make the grass grow. There's at least something there. We ran over that afternoon all the different powers that I could see that were greater than myself, and there were lots of them. I've never had trouble believing there's a power greater than myself. In fact, that's my first step experience. Everything I looked at has more juice than I've got, and I'm terrified. Everything. So, I believe there is a power greater than myself. It was all negative. And I had to come to believe in a power greater than myself that was positive, and his name was Bruce, and his name was Roy. And they said, no, it isn't us. You can't surrender to us. We have been changed. So I guess I surrendered to the power. I thought I surrendered to the group. I didn't. I surrendered to the power that changed their lives. By simply understanding, I don't have a concept. I didn't have one to choose. There had to be a power greater than myself that could change my life, because I was stuck in a body that wouldn't die, carrying a mind that wouldn't work, and I was out of choices. And that's what I got led to. So, if you want to use it as a textbook, there's the question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself?
Then there's the believer. Or he's a pious man. The bigot says, I know, and he's filled with contempt prior to any investigation. Not willing to... He's the guy that usually says, I saw that chapter, but I'm not an agnostic, so I went on to how it works. Well, how could there possibly be anything for me in a chapter called We Agnostic? Because I know there is a God. They describe it later on in the book as contempt prior to investigation, contempt without any consideration at all. He's not so hard to work with, and there's a little bit of that in all of us anyway. But then there's the guy that's really hard to work with, because he not only knows there is a God, he believes there is a God, and he uses God to justify it. Now, he's not filled with contempt, he's filled with acceptance. He just accepts everything. My friend says, you can usually tell him by the last guy he talked to. He's the nodder and the shaker. Hardest man in AA to work with, because he believes, before approaching any of this, that there is a God. So there's parts of this chapter that help you see that maybe you don't believe. Just like there's parts of the first step that we could have touched on that help the guy that knows he's an alcoholic look at the idea that maybe he isn't. So for some of us, as with me from time to time, it's not only been beneficial to look at the idea that maybe after all this and all I know, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. It's also beneficial for me at times, it has been, to look at the idea that with all this great knowledge and all this wonderful experience and things that I can't write off to myself pulling off, maybe I don't believe that beyond here, beyond this experience, beyond what I've been given, beyond what I know, there's more for me. That's always the proposition, whether it's the new guy or the guy that's been around forever. Do I believe, right with where Don just read, do I believe that for me there is a power greater than myself that can take me beyond where I am? Whether you're talking about day number one, getting to day number two, or whether you're 19 years sober and you're talking about making it past what you believe after 19 years, or however many years. So there's some great stuff in this chapter that helps me see other things that I believe in that I disguise as God. People, sentiment, money, myself, the God of reason. It talks about honest doubt and prejudice. So sometimes using this chapter to see where you don't believe, so you can get to a simple place that he just read, back to that simple willingness from a place of, you know, I really don't know, but let's go for it, and get past all these preconceived ideas that I have. Sometimes to approach the second step with certain people, it's really beneficial to look at where you don't believe before you decide that you are willing to. And then for those that love to live in our heads, we get this idea that God is either everything or is nothing. And there's a big sigh of relief in people like me, because I can't figure, even my ego knows I can't figure out everything. And all of a sudden it's gone from something I put in a little 3x5 box to something infinite and powerful beyond my own imagination. That maybe for me, beyond where I am now with all this time, there could be more. There could be dimensions of peace and freedom and joy and love that I haven't even dreamed of. See, because if this is it, no matter how long you've been sober, if this is it, then God isn't everything. But if God really is everything, which is our choice, and I don't know how a guy like me, the first time through this or any time since, I don't know how a guy like me gets taken to a place through a simple process where he gets to choose about God and power. I don't know how that happens. But somehow, between some kind of an admission about me and booze and some kind of willingness about me and power and some kind of openness to accept something beyond what I could figure out, I was given the grace to make a choice at the second step. Everything or nothing, he either is or he isn't. What is my choice to be?
Any questions? Sir.
Charlie.
Hi, Charlie.
So absolutely. There's a wonderful new definition for the term insanity. That's when we go do the same thing over and over and expect different results. And yeah, I think somehow the new understanding of God has to come about, whatever it is. But like Don, I couldn't give you my concept. I don't know. Yeah. There's something new about the relationship.
Before we take a break, because of the continuity will come from this, I ask you to consider this. They've summed it up again. First, here's what it's going to taste like, feel like, smell like, and be like. They found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. Do I want that? Oh, yeah. Consciousness and the presence of God is today the most important factor of their lives. And that can change forevermore. And I don't get balanced. The consciousness and the presence of God is today the most important factor of my life. Is that true or do I want it to be true? You want to take a little break?
There was a question on page 45, once confronted with this idea of lack of power, that says, where and how are we going to find this power? That's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Isn't it amazing that in 10 pages later, they tell me exactly how and exactly where to find the power? On page 55, the paragraph starts off, actually, we're fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it's there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves And miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of a God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly. That's how. Same two words as in the fourth step, searching and fearless. Search fearlessly. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. That's where. So they answered the question, where and how. They gave me a direction. They gave me a way to find this power, and they gave me a direction to go, because all my life I've been looking out here. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. Page 60. The description of the alcoholic, step one. The chapter to the agnostic, step two. And my personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that I'm alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. B, that no human power can relieve my alcoholism. And C, that God can and will if he is sought. I needed to be convinced of these three pertinent ideas. Then I was ready to look at step three. I really got pissed off when they told me there was a requirement, because I'd been to a lot of meetings on the third step, and I never heard anybody ever say, and these were people that were doing this, I never heard any, maybe I just didn't hear it. I never heard anybody say there was a requirement to take the third step. And in the next paragraph it says, the first requirement is that I be convinced that my life, run on my will, can hardly be a success. And when you see that your life, run on your will, cannot be successful, then there's a good reason to turn your life, run on your will, over to the care of God. And if you have seen it by then, they give you about a page and a half that to this day I still hate, because it describes me at my very best, without God in my life. This is what I do. And they go through it. I love when I get to this with somebody to have them read it in the singular, that rather than putting we or us or them, to read it about themselves. This is what I do. The actor, even when my motives are good, even when trying to be kind, even in my best moments, I'm a producer of confusion rather than harmony. To move through that, to get to a state of consciousness where you've absolutely met the first requirement of the third step, and that is to be convinced that your life, run on your will, can hardly be a success. Then to consider the third step decision. On the bottom of page 62. Actually, there's a statement in the middle of that page that I want to touch on, but I'd like to come back to it when these guys talk about inventory a little bit. But it is worth looking at now to begin to find some freedom from it rather than the way we used to beat ourselves up with it. And that's in the middle of the page, and that's the idea, which I think is one of the greatest statements of hope in this big book, that our troubles are of our own making. That we should come back to when we get to the fourth column of the resentment inventory. And at the bottom of the page, we find what was told to me to be the third step decision. I thought it would be doing the prayer. They told me the decision comes before the prayer, and that is that I should decide that from hereafter in this life, God is going to be the director, the principal, and the father, to consider what those terms mean to me, and for me to be the actor who wants to quit running the whole show, an agent of God, and a child of God, in my own way, to consider what those ideas mean to me. And from the first time, they certainly mean more than they did then. I don't know if that makes it any important or not, probably not. And then we did that prayer. And then I learned to ask the greatest question I ever learned to ask in Alcoholics Anonymous, which seems to be a mystery in AA nowadays. And it's no longer a mystery to me, because I got off my knees and I said, if that was just a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, how do you turn it over? And thank God he said 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. I mean, we throw this term around nowadays like newcomers are supposed to understand what we mean. They share some terrible problem, and we go, just turn it over. And thank God he told me there were precise directions on how to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. and we began with an inventory.
On page 63 is another one of those little mercy places. The beginnings of a spiritual event, spiritual awakening, and a spiritual experience happened and should happen prior to the taking of the prayer, and did. And it feels like this. We had a new employer. It's an attitude. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed and kept close to him and performed his work well. I can ask myself, have I in any degree experienced some of these things? Not totally, but to any degree. Do I have a sense that I'm no longer in charge? Yeah. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, in our little plans and designs. Has that begun to happen to me? But as I'm probably feeling a little bit weird. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. I was beginning to experience that. As we felt new power flow in, has that happened yet? Have you felt a little new power flow in? As we enjoyed peace of mind, 5-10 seconds a day at the beginning. As we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and hereafter. We were reborn. I get my new mind in some way. Now, I would, we got so much to do. I'd just like to share a couple observations with you from my experience about the rest of this process. I'm now going to be seeking conscious contact with God. I've made a decision, and I'm going to open that up. At the end of this third step prayer, as you all know, in spiritual terms, the word amen means closure. So be it. It's done. And I find it interesting that there is no amen at the end of the third step prayer. But there is one at the end of the seventh step prayer. And in between there are a number of other little prayers. But I have concluded, for me, that this is a spiritual process, not an intellectual process. So everything from the word God at the beginning of the third step prayer to the amen at the end of the seventh step prayer is part of the same prayer. I learn now that prayer is activity, not just thought and words. Prayer is action. That makes this whole inventory process a spiritual activity, not an emotional or mental activity. I thought that I was going to have to spend my whole life finding out who I was. And this process says that isn't what we do here. We will help you find out who you're not. We'll dispose of that, and then whoever you are will just show up, because God can't abide a vacuum. Mm-hmm. Now, can I reconcile that with the big book? I can. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect. God, do I need permanent effect? Unless it once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. That's what I need. To face and be rid of. I'll find out who I'm not. God will remove that, it says, and there I'll be, a new person standing there. And then I have to learn how to live by the principles and to grow up that way. What a change in attitude that is for me. I can now face the stuff I'm unable to face otherwise. I nearly got my children killed because of my activities. And it's not possible to face that unless I know that I don't ever have to do that again. If I can get rid of the kind of thinking that brought that event about, then I can face it. Otherwise, there's no way. I can't face the things I did to my family unless I know I don't have to do that again. And there's the promise that made it possible for me to carry out the rest of the activity, to be rid of. And then, of course, Gary can explain it. We use a checklist method as we go through this. We're now into specific directions on how to do this. And so I'll read a sentence. It'll tell me what I'm going to do and how to do it. And I ask myself, have I done that yet? We took stock. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Have I done that yet? No. So how am I going to do that? Gary, you want that?
Thanks for bringing that up. I That was another one of those things that happened to us, was that we discovered that if this is a text, then maybe it would work that way. And so that's exactly what we did. If it had three lines that said, go do this, we would ask each other as we went along if we had gone and done this. And that took us out of our heads and got us down to the practice. Today, God knows how many inventories later, and all of that, I still do the same thing. I still get a piece of paper and I turn it sideways and I draw four columns. And I haven't found a more exotic way that works. And it just seems to work that way. When we were messing around with this at first, Don was sticking pretty close to the big book, and I got off into the Hazleton guy and the 12 and 12. And I want you to know I was severely confused to begin with. And I got worse. And I was doing all this writing, and it didn't mean anything. I would write all this stuff down, and I'd look at what these things said, and nothing was happening. And somewhere in there, Lee and I were reading the Hazleton Guide, and we got to the point where it said, stop, wait a minute, take a break, and we threw that sumbitch away. And I've never seen one since. I haven't had a good one. But shortly after that, things started to work that way, and they still do today. And I still start out my inventory with the resentment. In this case, the example is he was resentful at Mr. Brown. My resentment generally starts, I'm resentful at Mrs. Brown. And or God. My children, my boss, any number of those people I run to on a daily basis. And during those times that I was doing things a sober man shouldn't be doing, those people as well. I don't make the list. Some people will make the list and then go back and go down the column on why they made the list and all that. I'll do each one as I do it. Because it's fresh, and I think at that moment I'm willing to look to see where I'm wrong and what I'm at fault. The cause and the example is attention to my wife, or told my wife of my mistress, or you may get my job at the office. I can do about that briefly. They don't mean that much more to me. I need to do enough, though, that I'm getting at what's really bothering me. I got to write it enough. Sometimes that's not enough to do that. Sometimes I have to write further just to see it, just to sort it out. And then years ago, one of the first fifth steps I took with a guy named Jim, who now lives down in Kentucky. We pronounce it Yosemite. I guess Kentuckians say Yosemite, but he taught me a little trick that when I'm doing it affects my sex relations or affects my self-esteem. He asked me to write down how does it affect my self-esteem. And so I'm not just trying to skate by with one word. I'm saying it affects my self-esteem because it makes me feel less than I should feel, or I already feel less than I should feel, and just kind of hammers it home. How does it affect my security? I may lose my job. Get specific. And then the hardest part of the inventory is still the fourth column. The book on page 67 says, we're referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And every inventory I've ever taken, this is the crux. This is the key thing. And there are many times where I'll get to that point and I'll look at it and I can't see it. And sometimes that's when her prayer's in order. Or just put it down and look out the window a minute and get back to it. And all that. But I have yet to find a situation where someone or something appeared on my resentment list where I was not at least one of those things. But nearly always all of those things. Anytime I find myself being self-seeking and frightened, I find myself being dishonest. Somewhere or another, I'm going to lie to you or to me. And it always kind of works that way. It just always does. I think, can't think of any other real principles I'd want to share with you with what I do with the resentment inventory. Joe shared with me, I guess it was last year down in Nashville, a thing in terms of dealing with fear inventory, and I'd like him to talk to you about that. And Don and I have fixed up enough sex inventory with each other, just bores the shit out of both of us. And so, Joe.
Yeah, for what it's worth, just briefly, this is a piece of really thorough, in-depth resentment inventory, lest you think this is a horrendous, forevermore experience. It's only one person, but it never takes more than one page. I've learned if I'm into the second page, I'm bullshitting again. This covers everything Gary talked about. Instead of, when I do it, I ask myself, why does this threaten me? Same basic idea. Where was I wrong? What was my mistake? Selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, fearful. And because it says, am I willing to set these matters straight, I put down what amends need to be made right here, and then cover further on in the 8th and 9th step. But that's all there is to it. It isn't that big a deal. You may have 100 of these, but no individual one of them should be a great big chore.
I was hoping he would read. He was going to read that to us.
It's for sale. Yours is for sale for $1.08.
They do talk about looking at this fourth column, and if anyone ever tells you that all you write is the example on page 65 and you don't write what Gary just read, it does say we put it down in black and white. We listed our faults. We put it down in black and white. It does say to write the fourth column. They just didn't put it in the example. I think in watching this phenomenon, I certainly haven't been writing as long as these guys, but in watching this phenomenon over the last couple of years, I think one of the best analogies I've ever heard is that this tricky inventory process takes what you think is the truth and turns it into a lie, and takes what you think is a lie and turns it into the truth. For example, a couple of years ago, and if I would have been new, I probably would have had a shit happens bumper sticker on my car, because that's what I wanted to remain. Right, a victim. And a couple years ago, she left me. I was engaged to be married, and she left me. And I put her name in the first column, and then I put she left me. And that, to me at that moment, right, that's the truth. She left me. And then you examine these seven areas of self, and they do give you six or seven. Self-esteem, ambition, pocketbook, personal relations, sex relations, security, pride, all the way down here in the example. And I examined these in a certain way also. And then I had to use a prayer, and they do give you one here, when it's hard to turn. There's actually a whole exercise of turning back to the list once and then turning back to the list twice. This first time they ask you to turn back is to look for the key to the future, to look at this person in a certain way so you can turn to your own mistakes. Sometimes those couple paragraphs are real helpful, and I had to do that. And then I was given the grace to write about my selfishness, my dishonesty, my self-seeking, and my fear. And you know what I saw? She didn't leave. I drove her away. And to get free, this is the amazing thing, she didn't have to come back or change. Now that, to me, a guy like me, is absolutely amazing. I've been waiting all my life for these people in the first column to change or get well or sober or come back to life from the dead for me to get free. And she didn't have to do either one, and all I did was move through 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Fear, the first time,
The first time, we went to page 68, and it said, to review your fears thoroughly. Now, here's a great question. Where do I find I can review my fears thoroughly? Well, Don shared that in his inventory, in the fourth column, he wrote about fears with that resentment. That's where I found my fear list. I found my fear list by going through the fourth column of the resentment inventory, and I started pulling out specific fears, and I started listing them. Now, they start repeating over and over. You don't need to list them over and over, so I got a list of general fears. Then I prayed. Some I had no resentment in connection with that weren't in my resentment inventory. Heights, snakes, spiders. But most of them I found in my resentment inventory. And I didn't repeat any. If I found some repeats on my fear list, I crossed them off. You can only put rejection, you know. You don't have to put rejection from mommy, rejection from daddy, rejection from your girlfriend. You put rejection, okay, or pain. There's only so many fears. And then the book says we asked ourselves why we had them. So it used to be a two-column fear inventory. Rejection. It's painful. I'll be alone. And I might take it out a little further of what I do with rejection. Scary thing about that is every one of them takes you right to alcohol. But what I started doing recently, because once you've done this kind of a fear inventory a couple of times, you can usually get to that there's really only a few. They all come down to just a couple. Most fear inventories done with two columns end up looking like a playoff chart. You start with 24, you end up with 8. Those are really about 4, but there's really only a couple. We each have some of our own stuff, but I usually come down to the same few fears. And I like to write 4 columns on those now. And I like to see, again, why I have them. I like to see how they affect these 7 areas in my life. I like to see what my ego tells me about these fears. And then I like to see where those fears cause harm through selfishness, dishonesty, and self-seeking. And I found a lot of harm from my fear inventory, and I had never seen that when I did a 2-column fear inventory. But the book basically says to list your fears and ask yourself why you have them. There is one thing, we were talking about it out front before, someone and I, and it's kind of interesting to me. I don't know if it would be to anyone else, but there's 2 thoughts here about fear. One on the bottom of 67, didn't we ourselves set the ball rolling? And then one that always kind of confused me, sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. Now, I'm not a kleptomaniac. And when I decide to steal something, I decide to steal something, and it's a conscious decision. So is this idea that I set the ball rolling when it comes to fear. So a friend of mine asked me, is it possible fear is a conscious decision? And I look at this list of fears and I said, you must be crazy. I never decided consciously to be afraid of rejection or pain or snakes. I never decided that. He said, what if I could show you one decision that you have consciously made throughout your life from time to time that set up every fear you've ever had? And I saw it. My decision to rely on self. And that's exactly what the book says next. Isn't fear because self-reliance fails? And I see that my conscious decision to rely on self sets up every fear I've ever had. And fear is a conscious decision. And I do set the ball rolling, and it should be classed with stealing. To move into sex, I was told to make a list. Some people think that first direction means to review conduct after you've made your list. I now do both. I make a list of relationships that need to be looked at. All these lists came from prayer. My fear list came from my resentment inventory. My resentment list came in prayer. People, institutions, principles. Now I'm asked to make a list. And I made a list of relationships. Thank God. I don't know if it's a testament to my health or a testament to my age, but the longer I'm sober, the shorter my sex inventory gets. That's a terrible realization right now. But I make a list of relationships. I now review conduct, and you can do that in paragraph form if you choose to review conduct. I review conduct from the time we met till the time it ended or where it is now. Motives, the book talks about motives. Specific sex conduct. And then I answer 9 questions. Where was I selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Who did I hurt? I look around the relationship also, not just her. There were kids, there was a boyfriend, there was a mother, there was a father. Where did I arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where was I at fault? And the one question Don warned me not to write if I didn't want to change in this area, and that's, what should I have done instead? So we find 9 questions, and I just did it in paragraphs, answering specifically each of those 9 questions. And from this, we start to shape a sane and sound ideal. He said, go back through all these relationships where you wrote these 9 questions and look at what you should have done instead, what you wrote there. And from that, as a guide, you can start to shape this ideal the book talks about. And he said, write a couple pages about your chosen, because it does say it's a chosen ideal. He said, write a couple pages about what your ideals for the future, not the ideal woman, your personal ideas of what you would like to take into your future sex life. Ask God to help you mold them. Ask God to help you live up to them. And then they tell you what happens if you don't. And that's the only part of the inventory Don ever warned me about. He said, do not do that if you don't want to change in that area of your life. And it goes on to say the right answers will come if you want them.
I just have another little format for interrogatory. This is a good way to do it. We're giving a little latitude here. This is a simple little format that over the years, because I'm getting lazier and lazier, and this is so revealing, I'm going to read just a little of it so you get an idea. It's based on the big book. What is the fear? Well, that during this time I was afraid of being without money, because I was. The reason I was afraid is because I was afraid my wife would leave me. Now it says that self-reliance fails me. That's the problem. So I ask myself, how's that failing me? And for me to ask that question, I simply ask, what am I selfishly trying to keep, protect, acquire? Well, I was afraid my wife would leave me. I'm selfishly trying to make sure she stays because I need her. I'm okay if she's with me. And I began to see I'm not trusting and relying on God. Later on in the same inventory, I discovered I was afraid of being without money because I was afraid she would stay with me. But she would be supporting me and putting me down all the time. That's what I was afraid of. I was selfishly trying to keep her respect and love on my terms. I was afraid that my creditors would yell at me and not like me. And I thought that was funny. And discovered that what I was selfishly trying to do was keep everybody liking me, even people that I hadn't even met yet. And that's goofy. Not relying and trusting on God. This little format really has, over the years, become a simple, direct, in-depth way for me to look at the fears, too. So, because it says here the fear is a childish thing. A childish thing. A thing of childhood. And the only answer is one of the mercy deals. I cannot work out my fears by facing them. I had an experience of that just a couple months ago. I did some damage to my arm, and in part of trying to find out what the damage was, they gave me what they call an MRI. They got this cannon, and they put me in it. For an hour, I'm stuffed in a cannon, and the thing's right here. And I promise you, I didn't like that. To lay there with my nose touching, and knowing I can't get out and I can't move, set up some fear deep in me that I didn't even know I still had, and there is no way I could work my way out of that. But years ago, one of my spiritual awakenings is I found a quiet place within me where I can go. And I just went there. And then she'd say something about what they were going to do next, and I'd come out so I could give her an answer. And I'd get panic-stricken again, so I'd just go back. I cannot work out my fears by facing them. Some people can. I can't. It says, instead, we ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. The only time I can go talk to him is when I go to my quiet place, and there he is. And we visit. And it's over. It's worked for years. But the kind of fears that will drive me crazy are the ones like this that I set up in my mind. I became afraid I was losing my mind once. It wasn't working right. I couldn't remember things. Because I would become custodial and someone else would decide my life for me. That's what I was afraid of.
selfishly trying to control my own life and make my own decisions again, not trusting and relying on God. When I found through that fear, the big deal is that I was afraid I'd have to feel afraid and anxious all the time. That frightens me to feel afraid. And the reason I wanted that is because I want to feel good all the time and to not admit that my mind doesn't always remember things or function perfectly. I didn't want to admit that. So it reveals this to me. And I go to the quiet place and I say, please remove this from me and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And I had one of the greatest awakenings of my life doing that once. I discovered I'm not what I do. It says, direct my attention to what you would have me be, not what you would have me do. And I'll just let you play with that. We're running short.
Getting short. We all have had our fifth step experiences, and we've all listened to fifth steps, and we've all shared our fifth steps. And a few years ago, I went to Chicago at the advice of a man who's now 44 years sober. And I shared an inventory with he and eight other guys. Not at the same time, but one after the other. In a fifth step situation like that. And there wasn't anything special about it. We had all written many inventories, so they weren't very dramatic. They were very much like we were talking about here. And so it didn't take long for us to do that. But it did what I needed done at the time. And every fifth step I've done over the years has done what I needed done at the time. If I sat down and got honest with them, whoever it was. Years ago, I got confused by the 12 and 12 regarding step 6. And I thought it was real heavy to quote the first line in it. It's when it says this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And as I looked at it further and further, it made even less sense. And I got caught in the vicious circle that it took me in to where I couldn't manage my life to where I was trying to manage it again. And it got a whole... got yards and yards away from becoming willing to have God remove my defects of character. And somewhere I caught on in there that the advice in the big book is just super for this. It says we take an hour after our fifth step and we review what we have done. And when ready, we say something like this. And it says the prayer and it has the amen that Don talked about. My experience with that is, briefly, that I can't make my defects go away. I can't remove my shortcomings. And I got a history of proving to you by God that I can't remove it. It doesn't work that way. But to say the prayer and the amen and so be it, let him do it and quit practicing my old habits, the defects seem to disappear. One thing those guys did when I had finished my fifth step, I did this over a weekend, a Friday night and a Saturday and a Sunday morning. And then we had lunch together, some of them and myself. And those guys had a wonderful memory. In fact, they held a group conscious meeting and they had me write down my amends list. They remembered it better than I. And they said, well, what about this one? Do you owe her an amend? Or what about that one? Do you owe him an amend? And I completed an amends list there. Now, the book says we have it because we wrote it when we took inventory. And I'll concede that most of my amends list was in my inventory. But in this case, I've been sober for years, and there were people there truly with no resentment or fear of that I still owed the amend, and they had to go on the list. And so I left Chicago that Sunday with a new amends list and a commitment to get the amends done, really, this time. And got home and I sat with Julie and we discussed it. And most of the amends were financial, and they weren't all of them, and I'm not going to get into all of that. But Julie and I have been sober and active in AA and Al-Anon for many, many years, and a lot of this stuff dated back to drinking days. But most of it was stuff that happened after sobriety. We would do whatever it was that was necessary to make these amends, and they were financial. These weren't people that were done in us. These were things that they'd long forgotten about ever being able to collect from. They'd forgotten, I hadn't, Julie hadn't. So we began to work on this process, and a couple of years went by, and or three, and we weren't getting anywhere. I'd make a few payments here and there, and then being a straight commission type guy and not particularly good at what I was doing, I'd miss a payment and all of that, and it was crazy, and we weren't getting anywhere. And Julie said a year and a half or so ago, maybe we ought to sell the house and take the equity out of the house and make these amends, and maybe there'd be enough left we could buy a mobile home or something. And I thought, God, I hope she isn't serious. And I tried to dust it. I really did. I wanted to pretend she didn't say that. And the next day I came home from work and I said, I think you might be right. Let me check with Paul. And so I called that guy in Chicago. And I told him what we had been discussing. And I said, you've been real quick over the years to tell me when I'm local. What do you think of this? And I said, we're talking about selling the house, taking the equity, paying off all these old amends, and living, maybe buying a mobile home or living however we have to after that. But we think we need to do that to get all this taken care of. What do you think? And he didn't say anything for a few seconds, and then he said, I think that's the sanest thing I've heard you say in 20 years. Are you sure it was your idea? And so I said, no, it's Julie. And so we did. Took us a few months, you know, to sell the house, to get it fixed up so where we could sell it. And it sold a year ago February 28th. It was Julie's birthday. And the next day was the most fun we've ever had in our lives. It truly was. Because we got to call all those people, find out where they were, and track them down, and make the amend, and then send them the check. I hope you heard that. I had to make the amend, and then I sent the check. I could have sent the check and not made the amend. But there was the neatest thing that happened. I'll share a couple of them quickly. One, when Julie and I started this process 5 years ago, there was a man in Laramie that I had worked for while I was attending college who owned a clothing store. And when I left college, I left that job at the clothing store, and I was the best-dressed graduating senior to ever go out of Laramie. And I'd stolen all the clothes. I hadn't paid for any of them. And so I called John and told him what I'd done. And he said real quietly after a few seconds that he thought I had been stealing that shit. He hadn't forgotten, and it had been years. And I had made arrangements to make him payments, and I'd made him two or three, and then I couldn't make one. He called me and dunned me. And then he forgave me in the same phone call. He said, no, I don't want the money. He says, I really appreciate what you're doing, and I think it's great. I don't want the money. And so 5 years later, when I called him and said, all I said was, John, I'm in shape to pay you that money I owe you. What's your address? He immediately gave me his address. He forgot he forgave me. Pretty good chunk of change. I'd have forgot too, but 5 years ago we went and we started on the amend process, and we called Julie's folks because they'd given us / loaned us money over the years for this amend. And so we called them, and her dad got on the phone. And I called him, and God, he'd given us money. He's tolerated me like he wouldn't believe. You know, I know I just put him in nine kinds of hell. I can't imagine what he wants. I can, too. I've had daughters grow up and marry some real jerks, now that I think about it. I know what he felt like. But I called him, and I thanked him. for the love and the tolerance and the kindness he'd shown us over the years. And I said, you know, I really love you, and we're calling to try to set some of that straight. And he got all flustered, and he said, oh, shit, here's Grandma, and he handed off the phone. And so I went through that with her, and I said, by the way, have you any idea how much money you've given us over the years? And she said, right down to the last penny. And so we made arrangements to start paying it. And finally, and that was, you know, all these were paid off as last going, but there was a man in AA who lives in the Twin Cities who was on the speaker circuit a number of years ago, and he and our friends, and he called me one day to say, hey, I got to go make a talk in Virginia, I guess it was. And he said, I got some extra time. I thought I'd stop by and see you, spend a day with you and Julie before we went on. So I met him at the airport, and he looked me in the eye, and he says, Gary, you look terrible. I said, what's going on? And so I told him that tomorrow, that they were going to foreclose on our house. And I said, that's bad enough, and that's scary enough, but the worst part is Julie doesn't know that. As far as she knows, everything's just fine. I haven't had guests enough to tell her. And he was the first guy I had told us. Nobody knew, not even Don. And we're driving from the airport to the house, and he says, where's your bank? I said, downtown. He said, let's go down there and talk to them. I said, they don't want to talk. They're all done talking. And he said, let's go see anyway. So we drove to the bank, and we're walking in, and I know none of you guys ever had to go see the principal with your dad, did you? Sort of felt like. And so we went in there, and he sat down, and he's not there to negotiate. He says, how much it take to get him even? And they told him, and this guy was carrying, I have no idea how much money in cash and traveler's checks, but he bought me up even. It was a big chunk of change, you know. And we walked out of there, and then I really felt like I was leaving the principal's office with my dad, and I told him somehow or another that had to be taken care of. And he says, well, that's really not what this is about, but I understand what you're saying. And I didn't know what he meant at the time. So anyway, I called him last February, a year ago. And he's in an entirely different situation now. He's in trouble financially. The business he is in is shot, and he's really struggling, and things are different. But I called him, and we chatted to him for a while, and I said, I told you years ago I knew I had to set this straight, and I can now, and I need your address. And I feel like I owe you the amend because I have been afraid to talk about this for all these years. And so I want to send you the check. And he says, fine, I understand. And he began to laugh. And I said, well, what's so damn funny? And he said, well, when we were making all the money, we used to tithe. And our tithe was where we could help people. And most of the time it was drunks with their fanny in a crack here and there. They couldn't get it out. And he says, it just happened. There's nothing special. We did it all over. He says, the interesting thing is I'm just kind of sitting here and I'm struggling and I'm trying to do my job, and occasionally a check shows up. It just comes in. And I haven't called in a bet. And I'm only sharing these things with you because I want to make a point here, and because my experience with it is pretty recent with this business of making amends. Julie and I are freer now than we've ever been. And I want to include her in this, and we're running out of time, but I want you to know, for those of you who are in Al-Anon and are sitting here doing this, that I've watched her go through some of her things with some of the amends that were personal to her, and one in particular with my stepfather that was real exciting. And my wife was not allowed to go with me to visit my mother, made things a little tricky the last time we went home, and so she had to deal with that. And I've watched the amends be made with she, with myself, with my friend Jim, and some serious ones, and our friend Ed down south, the Pope of Morgan County, and all that. So we're watching the real effect that comes in sobriety from making amends. And I'm sharing this because I don't want you to make the mistake. I overlooked them for years. And God, what a horrible mistake, because the freedom came there. I felt better, and the fear left as I was going through 4, 5, 6, and 7. But the freedom came then. And so those things that seem so terrifying that, goddamn, there's no way I can go back to them and look them in the eye and make that amend. When you're there, not only is there no way, it's one of those musts that Don talked about. No, really. I didn't mean to dominate the end of this thing, guys. But,
you all are tough. And we have used up our time. Two last tiny little things. There's a key word in the sixth step in the big book that turns the whole deal around. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all those things which we have admitted are objectionable? I will not let go of anything if you threaten me. You can't frighten me. You can't make me angry enough. I will not let go for any reason except that I personally object to being that way. Somehow my ego has to be part of this deal, and that's how it happens, I believe. When I finally object to being this way, I'll quit. Then I'm willing to let God remove it from me. The making of amends we could spend hours on. In addition to setting it straight, it says this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And that's why I stay in this deal. If I were going to play football in that arena, I'd have to do certain exercises every day to stay fit, to play in that arena. And I need to be fit to carry God's word and his message. You don't just do that. And there's certain exercises I do every day so I can stay fit to carry this message. And by fit, that means willing. That's all. You told me that from the beginning. That's all I brought to this deal was willingness. I stay fit by staying willing to do this anytime, anywhere, with anybody. And as a result, my life is better than anything I could ever have imagined, and certainly better than I deserve. And I get to watch you all get better, and that makes me feel better. You really have been terrific. We thank you for your participation, because if you hadn't been here, we'd have sat here and lied to each other for 3 hours anyway. So thanks for coming.
I had one. I remember sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous before I was at the ninth step the first time, before he had told me anything to do. And I'm talking about my earliest resentment that I can remember. My earliest memories were full of resentment toward a father who was 57 years old when I was born. And there were people in that room that said, you will never be able to make amends to someone who's dead. And thank God that Don didn't sell the program short when we got to amends, because that's a resentment coupled with year after year of other stuff that plagued me my entire life. Spent 12 years in therapy dealing with this stuff, pounding on chairs, banging on walls, crying, everything. Never got anything but those feelings postponed. Let me see him or be reminded of him. And I did what I was asked to do in 4 through 9. And he told me to go to his grave just like I was going to somebody else. And they even gave me a format. Sometimes hard to pull the directions out of step 9 as far as how do you approach somebody. And he said whether it was face to face or in a letter or on the phone, whenever I could, I should do it face to face. Or if it was at his grave, that I should follow a simple format. This last time through the work, I didn't have a big inventory because I had done some work last year. I just hadn't finished the amends. I was so inspired by our visit last summer with Gary. I couldn't get back into amends. I did a short inventory. I fist-stepped it with a few people. I put those amends with my old amends, and I finished them for the first time in 2 years. And the funny thing about it is I didn't have a big inventory. But some of the stuff in that inventory was about Christians in my life. And a business associate
that Don and I know that I never wanted to be involved with ever again. And a relationship that wasn't over, but it was over. It was still in my head, those old hooks. And a group in Los Angeles that will remain unnamed. And everything in that inventory I was put right in the middle of before I was finished with those amends. And by the time I was finished with those amends, everything that I thought I was stuck with, everything I didn't think was going to go any further, took off. A business deal with some Christian people that I never thought I could be involved in again, involved in a group that was in my last inventory. Everything I wrote about, I'm right in the middle of today. And I went to this girl's house that I was engaged to a couple years ago, and I told her why I was there. This is the format they gave me. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I need to do to stay sober is clean up the past, and I don't ever want to drink again. And this is the harm that I'm clear on. Boom, 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 boom. Is there any other harm that we need to talk about? And get it all out there on the table. And then I asked with reluctance, do you need to tell me how any of this hurt you? And I listened. And then I asked, what can I possibly do to make this right? Is there anything I can do? And can you forgive me? And walked out of her house free for the first time in 2.5 years. Sobbed like a baby the whole way home and didn't know how free I was. I had spent several months thinking I was free. Didn't know how free I was until the next day when she called and she thanked me for coming over and she said, you know, maybe now you and I can be friends. And the hook was gone. And the day I left my father's graveyard, after not being able to go there for 9 years, I was headed for the airport. And this little quiet voice said, no, you're going to take a drive. And I drove through the neighborhood where I was born. And I drove through the neighborhood where I grew up and where I used drugs and where I drank. And I was free from those pulls that had been there every time I'd been home sober. I mean, the amends process is not to be missed. And I absolutely admire with all my heart, not like out of a respectful way because I know they're drunks, but I admire anybody in this program with the kind of time that these two guys have, who with that much time would be willing to submit themselves to this process one more time and then watch their whole life take off. That's exciting to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope there are always people, as long as I'm sober, that tell me to keep going for it, that there's always more and there's always more freedom and there's always more peace and there's always more joy and love.